Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. This is a bit of a bonus episode. This week we're releasing two episodes at the same time. We also released an episode previewing our Senate debate with Bob Shrum and Melanie Mason. We encourage you to listen to that. This is a conversation with Chris Matthews, the longtime host of Hardball on MSNBC and the best-selling author of so many different books. He is with us. He is so interesting to listen to, and we had to cut his interview way down for TV purposes just because of our time restraints, but online we don't have them. So why not have more Chris? This is like double, triple the Chris that we got to do on TV. Chris, in his own words, talking about Trump and Biden and Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis and also Jimmy Carter, who he worked for, and his favorite movies and his fears about democracy and the state of the world. And if you love that show, which I loved that show, I think you'll really appreciate this conversation, and I hope you give it the time and breath, and it's a bit like having a really great political science teacher, especially if you're like me and studied poli-sci. It's like going to class with Chris Matthews, and it's a real treat. So here is Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews, welcome back to The Issue Is.
It's great to be on. Thank you.
So former President Donald Trump is facing 91 felony counts, two states now actively trying to keep him off the ballot, and yet his poll numbers keep going up, remaining dominant. Let's look at the latest Real Clear Politics average of polls showing Trump with 51% support in Iowa, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in second with around 19% support. Let's go to New Hampshire now. Big lead for Trump there as well. Trump at 46%, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley around 25%. At this point, Chris, can Trump be stopped?
Probably not, because of the MAGA factor. It's an unusual thing in politics to see such solidity in support. I mean, I have a brother like this. I had three of them who voted for the first time. One is going completely the other direction. One of them is off him, but there's one that's still with him. There's something about it's a societal thing. And my brother puts it this way: I'm for Trump, and so are all my friends. He always says it the same way: and so are all my friends. It's, I think, out there in the rural areas, in Pennsylvania, for example, where you get away from Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and Penn State, and you get where it's about 70%. I think that's up to 75 to 80% now. I think it's a real challenge for the Democrats, because that's blossoming out there. And there are a lot of cultural factors that the president of Harvard withdrawing herself from that position, the border situation. It's a classic example of a mob at the gate. Listen to the line here: the mob at the gate and the rot at the top. Stefanik is out there talking about the rot at the top. The rot at the top is a key factor in this kind of push against the authority figures in our country. This is all about, they're grouping them all together. And Joe Biden, for whatever reason, is put right in the middle of the elite and defending the mob. So he's defending the mob, and he is among the elite. And this huge mass of people in the middle, the working people, middle class people, whatever you call them, are aggrieved. And it's a bit of Gulliver's Travels. It's about the repressed majority and the elite at the top. And Harvard was a perfect target, because it consolidates all this grievance. I know it isn't the same out west as it is in the east. Back east, we're all focused on the Ivy League and Georgetown and a couple of places like that. And there's a sense of, I didn't get in, or I applied, but I didn't get in. And just look at the numbers of people that apply to Harvard every year, and a small percentage that get in. And this is true of MIT and Yale and a lot of other schools. So there's a tremendous sense of being on the outside.
Yeah.
And Joe Biden is seen as being on the inside.
Right.
This is so ridiculous.
Well,
he's
not
an insider. Look at Joe Biden. He's some plays golf down at Rehoboth, you know? He's just some guy, you know, who went to Syracuse, who went to Delaware University. He's not part of the elite.
Well, he's been a senator since he was 30 years old. I mean, he's been a part of the elite for a long time.
But
then you think of how amazing is it, though, that Donald Trump, a guy who is literally a billionaire, who lives up in a golden tower, has become the guy for the folks who are trying to take down the elite. It's amazing how he's pulled that off.
And of course, on the side, he brags about having going to Wharton at Penn.
An Ivy League school.
He gets it both ways, just like Howie, just like J.D. Vance. The whole bunch of them are pulling this number. Don't you see it? They all went to Ivy League schools. They are elite culturally and economically, and yet they play this role. This is very smart. It's a double life. They're internally, they've had the advantages of our society, but externally, they're the guy on the street corner begging for quarters. I don't know. He just, you know, it's such a good game for the right wing people to play.
So Nikki Haley has seemed to have sort of won this race for second among the folks going up against Trump. Do you think she has an actual path to beat him, to become the Republican nominee?
Well, look, I think in the most simplest terms, and you know, I get in trouble for this, but it's what people want now. If you see her on stage, she's very very dynamic, very animated. It's a stage presence. You know what that is. It's an ability to portray something a little more animated on stage as opposed to something dull and static. I mean, even Vivek's got it, although outrageously. But they're all out waving their arms. They're visible. They're animated. They're dynamic. And I think that really matters. And I think she has that. So I think she has that quick appeal of somebody you want to listen to a little bit. The other guy, DeSantis doesn't look likable. Barely or not, unlikable. And he doesn't, his face conjoins up. It gets very tight and unhappy. He doesn't like criticism. He goes after people in the crowd when they question him. He doesn't like people in that sense. Don't question me. And I think that comes across. And I think people would like to, you know, who's going to sit next to on an airplane and just chat with? It's a great question. Who's going to stop and give you help when you get a flat tire? Always the greatest question. If you have a flat tire, who's going to stop and ask and give you some help? And I'm not sure how either of them come out on that, but I think she's more likable, and that does matter. That matters a lot, especially in the early going when you have a primary in New Hampshire. You're not going to know much about them. She'll be campaigning a lot in the next 2 or 3 weeks. I think she did get over, to some extent, the failure to know that the Civil War was about slavery. I mean, well, the fact is, we know there was slavery before it, and we know there was no slavery after it. Get it? I mean, as kids, we went down to see Mount Vernon, and we saw the slave quarters sort of as antiques, and I'm not sure we had a strong emotion at the time. But I think everybody knows what it was about. Even go watch Long Gone with the Wind, watch something iconic like that. It's all there, or 12 Years a Slave. I mean, all the movies are about it, and we know what it was about. I can't believe, but she had the Marco Rubio problem. Remember Rubio last, when he was up in New Hampshire, and he repeated some neocon, I don't know, what do you call it, gambit. He repeated something 6 times in the same debate.
Right, Chris Christie.
I saw him at church I saw him at church the next day, and I got, you poor guy, he's surrounded by his friends. It was a prayerful moment, but what caused it? Why did he go into this zone of just talking neocon talk,
right?
And this is like Jerry Ford saying that Eastern Europe wasn't under Soviet hegemony. Well, give me a break. The guy went to Yale Law. He's pretty smart. Didn't he know that Berlin, I mean, that Poland and all of the Eastern Bloc were all in the Warsaw Pact? Doesn't he know these things? Yes, he does. There's something in the way these guys train and teach themselves to answer questions that becomes pretty robotic.
Yeah, too focused on the consultants and not focused enough on being yourself.
Yeah, and about President Gay and McGill and all that, and Harvard
too
and,
cute
and
by Penn. Half. Right.
They were talking, they were preparing themselves to address a riot from the pro-Hamas people a couple weeks down the road instead of answering the imminent question. Is it all right to call for the death of Jewish people?
On a gut level. Let's talk about the general election. The Real Clear Politics average of polls shows that Trump is actually ahead of Biden by about 2 points. Of course, we're a ways away. National polls don't ultimately matter. It's about swing states.
What do those two numbers tell you? How far is he ahead in the Electoral College?
Right, exactly.
And, right there, because he's already California is 4 or 5 million. New York's a couple million, 7 million altogether. And so that you just take that off, you still win in the Electoral College if you're if you're Trump. You can still do it.
And it's, broadly speaking, it appears clear that Biden has an enthusiasm issue right now among Democrats, especially young people. And he's at risk for them, not that they're going to vote for Trump, but that they don't vote at all. And then Trump's people who are excited about him show up and they win. What does Biden do about that?
Okay, it's first of all, that's very helpful to no labels. They love that number because they say, oh, we can have a younger Joe Biden. We'll run a younger Joe Biden for president. Let's say, why don't we think Joe Manchin? He's a younger Joe Biden. He's only 4 or 5 years younger, but he's a jock. And he comes across as a jock. He's really healthy. He doesn't walk like that. They can do that. They can do it with Larry Hogan or somebody. You know, they're going to find somebody. They're going to run somebody. That's trouble. Bobby Kennedy's trouble, too, because and so is Cornel West and Jill Stein. They're all possible anti-Trump votes that Biden won't get. So if he's lacking enthusiasm in the debates, for example, which we'll all watch, what do we do? You'll vote for the more brisker version of Biden. And that means one of the third party candidates. That's real trouble. It's real trouble.
And another issue that seems to be dragging down and splitting the party recently is immigration, with some of these big city Democrats frustrated.
Well, who didn't know that? Who didn't know it was going to be a problem?
Well,
and I don't think it's, I know it's more familiar to people who live on the border in California and Texas and all, but in Arizona, but when people started coming up to the Northeast. I mean, if you read Franklin Forrest's book about Biden, he knows that when people see them up north, it's more of a problem. It's they're unfamiliar. Who are these people? Where are they here? Where did they come from? Speaking Spanish? What's that all about? They're wondering about, how did they get in? Did they apply to get in? Did they work their way in? Are they like somebody in Eastern Europe that applied and waited in line? No, they didn't do that. They just came in because they wanted to. They had to. They felt they had some sort of plan for it. Justification under asylum rules, but they're here. And I think there's a lot, and they're in numbers, huge numbers. And that's always going to, any kind of immigration that comes in big numbers are an issue with people. It is an issue to people. And so who didn't think this was going to be a problem? And Biden knew it. He said that people don't distinguish between the person who leaves here to flee tyranny with the person who comes to the United States for a better life, like most people did. My grandparents did. That's how people come here, to get a better life. And they think that's why they're here. And they go, why is that any different than the guy who claims to have an asylum situation? And also, he also understood it's a bigger problem up in Michigan, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Ohio. He knows where the problem will hit artists. But he hasn't been able to find a way. Maybe it's dealing with the Hispanic leadership. He can't find something that, you know, they had a great solution years ago with Ted Kennedy and even Lindsey Graham, where they were going to basically let people come in a reasonable number, but they would make everybody who's in here in our country regularized, documented. 11 million people would no longer have to fear the law. That could be a pretty good deal still. You're all here, but we have to slow this number down. I don't think the Republicans are going to help them.
Right.
I don't think they want it. I think they want the issue. You know, if you watch television, if you watch the more liberal programs on MSNBC or CNN, they talk about the plight, and it is a plight, of the people drowning in the water and the Rio Grande, and just basically trying to survive the crossing to the north. And then you get the other side, which is get them out of here.
Yeah, invasion, right.
And I think people are, and both possibilities are in a lot of people's hearts and heads. It's not all we don't care, and it's not all it's anti-Hispanic. I mean, people know Hispanics; they don't have any kind of real turn off. But it's a sense of this is out of control.
Yeah,
it does look out of control. I mean, all the people waiting in line to be naturalized, and if you've ever been to a naturalization ceremony, you cry. It's so wonderful because people have waited in line, learned the language, learned what America stands for. And it's a wonderful experience. But this picture at the gate, doesn't look good. It's a mob at the gate. And people say, well, who's controlling the mob?
So real bottom line, do you think Joe Biden's in trouble right now?
Inflation is an issue. It's not I argue with my wife. She's a former chairman of the Democratic Party. And I have this argument with her all the time. It's not about the rate of things or the rate of murder in big cities like Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., where it's horrendous. It's about the prevalence of a new situation as opposed to an older situation. People can remember 2019, and they'll compare the price of Philadelphia cream cheese. A guy called me, a guy from Rhode Island, he said, what about the price of cream cheese? And I go, what was it? What is $7 now? What was it before? I don't even know what it was. And he said, it's terrible, because he can remember what it was in recent memory. You know, am I still on?
Yes. Chris, up next, Chris is going to reflect on his old boss, former President Jimmy Carter, and his wife, Rosalynn. Stay with us. More with Chris Matthews here on The Issue Is right after this. Here is a photo of a young Chris Matthews as a speechwriter for then President Jimmy Carter. Chris Matthews is back with us. Chris, we lost Rosalynn Carter recently. We know Jimmy Carter remains in hospice care. What do you want people to remember about the Carters?
I think it was, you know, I didn't know him well enough to get to the answer to this. I think he might have been a pacifist, meaning I think he really didn't like the use of guns, gunplay. And here's what I think. The first thing he did when he became president was to say what a great president that Gerry Ford was, that he had brought the country back to itself again after Watergate. First thing he said, when he went to the White House the first day in the office, the first thing he did was pardon all the people that went to Canada because of the Vietnam War. And he just, right across the board, this is a real use of the pardon. Everybody, and you know, it was never argued about again. Some of the military may have had a problem with it, but he basically said, I want this fight to be over with. I want to end the fight. The way to end fights is not to start a war like in Afghanistan or Iraq. That doesn't end the fighting. But if you say, I'm going to stop fighting about this thing, you know, about amnesty for people that see as shirkers of war or whatever, he said, no, I'm not going to do that. Then he went to, had brought the Egyptians in. He brought in Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin. He went to Camp David. And in 13 days, he worked out a deal where Egypt would recognize Israel. It's really its great potential enemy all these years and had never broken that treaty. And I think that's really powerful stuff. And the Panama Canal, which he said was the hardest thing he ever did, harder than getting elected in the first place. And he got that through. He's constantly trying to end wars. And even in the Iranian hostage situation, he was trying to figure out what he could do to end that crisis and get the hostages home. He didn't declare war, which would have probably gotten him elected again. He said, I'm going to bring those people home alive, all of them. And that means no war. Because as we know, we've learned recently, in war, hostages are killed. So he said, even though it cost him the presidency and his own humility, really, his pride, he made that decision. So I think he was a man of peace. And I think he paid a lot of price for it. And that's it.
What did he mean? What did he mean to you personally? How did he change your life?
Well, he was a kind man. I mean, he didn't like all the speeches, but after it was over, I had the same relationship with Tip O'Neill. Once it was over, it was much more friendly if you do an occasional speech for him or something as a favor. But he had a great sense of humor. He talked about his decision as a pretty young guy in the military, a high-ranking naval officer. He was going to be an admiral. And his wife saw that coming. Imagine being an admiral in Pearl Harbor, a place like that. There's some nice places to be an admiral in. And he said, no, we're going back to Plains, to this, as he calls it, this dinky town of Plains. And I'm going to get involved in business, and I'm going to be the peanut farmer. And he said she didn't talk to him for a year, that she rode in the car with him. She'd say things like to her son, tell your father that his wife wants to go to the bathroom. I mean, it was just like that. I mean, it was the old school. Of course, today, that argument would be much different for most Americans. It would be much more even-handed. Let's put it that way. It would not be, we're going to planes and you better like it, you know. But he was very honest about that. And he also grew up as a Black American, which most people can't even figure it out. All his playmates, all his people that took look after him, his neighbors were all Black. And that's where he grew up. And he only after he reached like 10 or 12 years old did he begin to realize that he could go into the movie theater, and everybody went to the movies in those days, and sit in a certain place, and the Black kids had to sit somewhere else. And when he got on a bus or a train, it would be different. But he said, I got the feeling that the parents back then were telling their kids, you got to start treating him like a white guy. It's so cutting and said so American in his experience that way. And I think that's why he was understood by Black Americans, because he grew up like that. And Bill Clinton, too. Bill Clinton was like that. They didn't grow up like Northern rich kids. They didn't know what that life was like. They know what it's like to be with regular people. You know?
Yeah, Southern governors.
Yeah, I liked him, and he was he didn't like Ted Kennedy. I mean, these are things you got to live with. You know, there's real rivalries, real rivalries.
Right.
And I think we were arguing on the plane one time about the commandments. You know, the Catholic commandments, I'm Catholic, are a little different than the Protestant ones. You know, we do worship one of the gilded images or something. You know, we do have statues in church. And there's a different number the way the Ten Commandments runs out.
Sure.
And so we were arguing over the one on lying and telling the truth. And funny things on planes when you're talking about what you got.
Sure.
But I loved it because, you know, there's nothing like typing out on a Selectric 2 what the President of the United States is going to stop and say at the next stop. There's nothing like that. That's fun.
That's pretty amazing. Up next, Chris, we're going to bring back one of your signature segments from your show. Tell me something I don't know.
Norah O'Donnell, tell me something I don't know.
For years, The Chris Matthews Show featured a segment called Tell Me Something I Don't Know, scoops and predictions from the top reporters and pundits in the country. I love that segment. This week, Chris is back on The Issue Is, so we're once again turning the tables on him. So, Chris Matthews, tell me something I don't know.
Anyway, that was Norah O'Donnell right there.
Yeah.
She's one of the panelists, and now she's head of, sitting in Walter Cronkite's chair right now. You know, this show, in addition to being entertaining and understanding and getting into the issues, is also about people feeling better about themselves. I worry about violence, okay? I think the tenor of the country with people who are in criminal cases, diving over the desk to get to the judge, Eric Swalwell being threatened the other day by a guy down in Florida, a guy getting killed out in Utah recently, with all the gruff language and coarse language, telling somebody to shut up as you just showed the program, I think it's going to lead to trouble. And I think people get confused about rhetoric and they think that's real and that it's going to somehow lead to something else in their lives. And there are a lot of people out there who believe all the wrong things. They think the election was stolen last time. They think they've been led to an awful lot of beliefs that are just wrong. And I think out of that's going to have some trouble. And the Democrats are going back to Chicago this summer. I mean, think about that, what the history of that has been. We've had a history in our country starting with Lincoln and Garfield and McKinley. And the two Roosevelts both shot at and survived with Cermak getting killed, the mayor of Chicago in 1930s. And we had Kennedy killed Reagan almost killed. And the bullet was right near his heart. And Harry Truman, two Puerto Rican nationalists, tried to shoot him at Blair House. We are a violent country. And the school shootings.
Yeah.
School shootings. You think they're not going to go after politicians? And the anger that people have, even since January 6th of 21, when people still believe the FBI did it or Antifa did it. I mean, I don't know how they get to those things.
Yeah.
Those decisions based upon watching. We watched it. We all watched it. I used to be a Capitol cop right at the doorway. My office is right near the door of the speaker's lobby, where you walk in, pictures of all the speakers of the House are there on the walls.
Right.
It's a nice place. It's where reporters get to interview people. And I know it really well. And I know what it was like to be a cop. And I think a lot of those cops were working class guys that didn't go to college, a lot of them. And they knew the people iconically coming through the doors in that riot. They knew who they were. The guys that you went to Knights of Columbus with or something like that. They knew them. They were like them. And they had to fight them for their lives.
Sure.
That happened. It happened in this country. An assault on our democracy. It's around us. What are we talking about? It might be there. It is.
Yeah, and there's still people that deny the Holocaust happened too, which is also crazy.
I've been the adjective chef. You got all the numbers right there.
All right.
They're all there.
Well, obviously that was sort of a depressing note, but a true note and something I've been talking a lot about lately as well. Let's end with something on a lighter note. This weekend, the Golden Globes kicks off award show season for California. Big deal for one of our biggest industries in this state. Globes, of course, honor the best of TV and film at one time. I always love when you used to talk about some of your entertainment favorites.
Chris, who's up for best film?
Well, there's a bunch of them, but let's talk about your favorites though. What is your favorite TV show?
American Fiction with Jeffrey Wright. He is astounding. And it's about, I would, it sounds weird. I just like to see with a more diverse audience because I think the African-American is going to have the most interesting reaction to this. This is a guy who was born to, if you will, standard English. He speaks incredibly like the best of the Ivy League, if you will. And but he has to go to sort of the argot, this sort of street level language to sell his book. So he writes this book, which is pretty hideous, but he's doing it for money. And it works. And it's writing. And I think being in an audience, a general audience would be a riot. Because like everybody will have a reaction to, how's this guy even know how to talk like this? And yet he does it in the kind of crudest, disgusted. He's disgusted with himself for doing it. And you think, this is America. This is so much about stereotypes and how we expect people to be and who they really are and how they can find it funny in an awful way. So I like Jeffrey Wright, and he went to St. Albans where my kids went, and I think that's great. And I also love The Holdover. You mentioned it before. I think The Holdover, Paul Giamatti, these guys, I saw him in Sideways the first time. He's just an errant. I saw him in John Adams. He was fantastic in John Adams. And here he is again, son of a Yale president, right?
Yeah.
Giamatti, yeah, Bart Giamatti.
Really, really, really good.
I think he was great, and I just watched – thank God to CCM, Turner Classic Movies. I watched It Happen One Night last week, and then I just watched Place in the Sun, George Stevens' great movie. There's so many great movies on TCM.
Yeah, and of course, some of the other big movies of this year, Oppenheimer, Barbie, Maestro. So we'll see.
Maestro
which
ends is fascinating.
Yeah.
I think Maestro is going to be talked about for a long time. I think Brad Cooper is really something else. And he's trying, he's reaching for the stars. He keeps going for bigger and bigger.
It's pretty big.
You know, he's a really impressive guy. He could be just doing the same role over and again, but no, he goes for the big ones, you know.
Well, Chris, I mean, thank you for always going big. We so appreciate you having talking with us, sharing your wisdom.
Well, I want to say this is going to be a white knuckle flight for people on the Democratic side. This is going to be close. Joe Biden is going to be 82. By the end of this fight, he's got to put on Harry Truman. He's got to do a Harry Truman. Harry Truman had to take on the left, the Strom Thurmond with the left with Henry Wallace, and then the Strom Thurmond on the right, the segregationists, and he beat them both and killed them because he had a good, strong economy. And I think Biden will have a strong economy this year, but he's got to get out there and do the whistle stops, campaign everywhere, and he's got to find the right role for Kamala Harris, which I think is talking to young people about their issues and all kinds of issues, not just abortion rights, all kinds of issues, and broaden her attack. This guy, he's got to build his cabinet up and use the cabinet. And some wealthy people like Buffett and people like that, they should be coming and saying the economy's in good shape and this guy brought us back. That's what I think.
Our thanks to Chris Matthews. That was a lot of fun. He goes all over the map and it was a real treasure to be with him, especially somebody who grew up watching and listening to him and reading his books. Next week on The Issue Is, as you heard, our pal Peter Hamby, and most likely Congresswoman Katie Porter. Thanks so much for listening. Please let us know what you think, and send me a note in social media, like, subscribe, all the things. Have a great week. Thanks for listening to The Issue Is.